It's Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Jack Begbie. This week, we're talking to Mark DiStefano, BuzzFeed Australia's political editor, about Twitter, memes, and how he became a political journalist. This interview was recorded in front of a live audience of student journalists. Enjoy. Now, you had a job at the ABC.
Yep.
Now, that's a job that every journalism student covets, and you gave it up to go to a job that was basically with a bit of a journalistic startup. What was it like going from the monolithic ABC that's online, audio, video, to BuzzFeed?
Terrifying, because I told my dad's a conservative Italian man, and I told him, hey, Dad, I'm leaving the ABC, I want to join this thing called BuzzFeed, and he said, what's that? And I said, oh, it's a website, like, go on the website. And I was on the phone to him, and he logged on, and he's like, do you want to write about like Kim Kardashian's butt and stuff? And I'm like, no, trust me, Dad. Like, we're going to, like, trust me, BuzzFeed is like serious. It's a serious journalistic organization. I watched, I was at the ABC for 4.5 years. The first year that I was at the ABC, I did not write one bit of copy. Like, I did not write one story. My first job at the ABC, I picked up Juanita Phillips's dry cleaning every day. And I would do her auto cue, and I would make her tea, and I would pick up Jeremy Fernandez's dry cleaning every now and then. But I would transcribe. I used to transcribe a lot, right? And so the problem is that people say to me, oh, you know, you left the ABC. I never got to the ABC through conventional means. Like, I went through what is strangely known and a little bit, like, I hope it's not too euphemistic, but I went through the back door. I applied for an ABC cadetship 4 times and I never got an interview. And I applied for Fairfax cadetships 3 times and I never got an interview. I did the test a couple of times. And the whole process taught me that the cadetship process was wrong and it got the wrong people into those jobs. And I think that that's the one message I always say to young journos. It's like, the hunger for reporting will always beat the person who has the better voice. I did a voice test at the ABC and they were like, you have a terrible voice. And I was like, well, okay. And then like a year later, I was reading the news on Triple J. So it was okay because they needed newsreaders. So it was fine. I'm already off on a tangent. What I will say is this. Why did I leave? BuzzFeed was doing incredible stuff in the US. And Ben Smith, who's the editor-in-chief, my boss, there's this great video of him at Neiman Lab, and he talks about journalism online in a way that, like, literally I was sitting in my little hut in Darwin going, oh my God, like, this is it. This is exactly what I want to do. The reporting that I wanted to do was via social media. Like, I thought he described social media as channels, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. It's like, they're just channels. And I was like going, ugh! And I was having these epiphanies. I'm like, yes. So when the Australian office opened, I was like, I have to apply. And the ABC wanted to keep me and I wanted to stay in many ways. But look, I think that I made the best decision of my career going to the Kim Kardashian website.
So when you joined BuzzFeed, you were BuzzFeed Australia's first political editor.
Yeah.
What was it like carving out an entirely new niche in BuzzFeed?
I mean, you've got to get a pretty thick skin. Like, you get criticized a lot. And the amount of times that I've been asked about clickbait and cats. Oh, BuzzFeed, what's it like working for a website that's all about listicles? And you're like, okay, all right. We got nominated for a Pulitzer this week, which was really great. Like, you know, the US team and the world team got shortlisted for the Pulitzer for international journalism. We've won the biggest award you can win in the UK for the UK division. And, you know, we were nominated for Walkley's for our first 2 years here. The problem is that you're coming up against journos who are worried about their jobs. And I fully appreciate that because I spent four or five years with them at the ABC. What was it like? Well, some people get it. Some people understand what we're doing. Other people don't get it. People who get it, George Christensen gets it. He gets what we're doing. He knows that calling me and giving me a story, and he knows that us having a fight on Twitter is good for him. Pauline Hanson gets it. The Greens get it, unsurprisingly. Far left, far right, they both get it. There are other people who don't get it, and they're worried, and a lot of those people work at, like, The Australian and things like that. So, look, what was it like? It was terrifying, and the thing that made me realise what my job was, like, the moment which I had full clarity about what I was doing was the Sydney siege. The Sydney siege at the Lynn Cafe was just up the road from my work. And I kind of was like flailing around at BuzzFeed. I'm like, oh, I don't really know what I'm doing, like, far out. It was like a couple of months in. Like, oh, I've made a terrible mistake. And then I went to the Sydney siege, and it was like the biggest story in the world, and it was breaking, and we were there. And my job was just to fact check everything that was on social media and all the garbage that was there. So I remember I saw a tweet from Chris Kenny from The Australian, who literally was walking out of the Lint Cafe siege. And he was just like, a gunman has just walked into the Lint Cafe. And I was like, sure he has. And then he sent another tweet. I'm like, Chris Kenny would not make this up. This is a bit strange. So I like quickly walked up the road to where the Lint Cafe was. And I saw these like terrified baristas with like a black Muslim flag. And I went, holy shit. And from that point onwards, I was there for about 13 hours straight. And my job was clear to me. It was like the ABC, Channel 7, Channel 9, 2GB, Triple M, all their reporters were down there, but they didn't understand social media. They didn't understand that like people want drip, 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 drip feed reporting from the scene. So until that moment, I thought I'd made a terrible mistake.
Now, at a recent press conference that no one showed up to, a Labour politician called BuzzFeed a failing piece of garbage.
Failing pile of garbage.
Failing pile of... Thank you.
Which takes, yeah, lots of pieces in a pile.
Mark Lathan, when he was attacking you via egg mode on Twitter, called you BuzzFed.
BuzzFed wanker.
Does that sort of view of BuzzFeed, people not understanding you, not getting you, does it make it hard to cover that big news, that hard news like the Sydney siege?
I'd be lying to say that it didn't hurt a little bit, because it's like, we're doing serious stuff, you know, we're trying our hardest. And, you know, I start work at about 6 a.m. in the morning and I finished about 8 o'clock at night. And if anyone follows me on Twitter would know that, like, if something breaks, I'll stop what I'm doing and cover it, because that's the job of a 24-hour reporter in the internet age. Look, Mark Latham, here you go. Here's a little bit of a exclusive scoop. Mark Latham contacted me and asked me to be on his TV show, Facebook TV show. And I was like, mate, I've written so many stories about why you're the worst human in Australia, because like you pretty much are. And there he was being like, can you come on my show? And I'm thinking to myself, like, it just shows you that like Mark Latham's calling me a wanker and a dickhead and all this sort of stuff online is just performance for his followers. But I kind of like my boss Simon says that what we want to be is like the punk rock in the internet. We don't want to be known as like the Coldplay. We want to be known as like the fucking scrappy upstart that people throw shade on. And that's okay. If places like The Australian and The Daily Telly and all this stuff give a shit, quite often it's because we're on the right track.
With those right-wing commentators, are you able to tell the difference between them just saying something for ratings and those commentators genuinely believing what they are saying?
No, because there are two guys in the Australian media which I find to be fascinating individuals for the next 20 years. It's Paul Murray on Sky News and Ben Fordham on 2GB. Two guys who are like relatively young. I think Paul is like 40. Ben Fordham is like in his mid-30s. Both are creatures of 2017. So both of them know that like gay marriage is settled. Climate change is settled. Like Paul and Ben both support climate change action and support gay marriage. But they run to the barricades on pretty much every other issue. On Islam, on this and on that, right? So if I think to myself as like, okay, so like Paul and Ben are going to be like our generation's Alan Jones and Ray Hadley. But Alan Jones and Ray Hadley just haven't figured out that like gay marriage and climate change has just been settled amongst a generation. We just need everyone to die out who's like over 60 at the moment, and we'll be okay on those big two social issues. So much of the media is performance. Like Malcolm Roberts from One Nation is a complete batty moron The problem I find with Malcolm Roberts is he's just a stupid man, and he got elected to be a senator, and you talk to him and you're like, oh wow, you don't know anything. You're literally an internet comment section come to life. And my problem with Malcolm Roberts is that he totally understands that we are his enemy for the purpose of performance. So he's banned BuzzFeed from press conferences just because we're the ones that are asking him the questions that he doesn't want to hear. David Lionhelm's another great example. David Lionhelm said this tweet once, which was like, we're all in our tribes and I've chosen my tribe. And Mark, you've chosen your tribe and we're at war. And I'm like, David, put down the red wine. It'll be okay. So much of the media is too inward facing and not outward facing. We're all criticizing each other and attacking each other, which is really sad.
Now, you mentioned that your working day starts at 6 and ends at 8. Is there such thing as work-life balance for someone in 24-hour news?
No. My partner works in finance and she doesn't know who the treasurer is. It's the best. I love it. Because it means that when I come home and I say something like, Mark Latham is trolling me on Twitter, she'll be like, who's Mark Latham? And I'll be like, this is why I love you. Work-life balance. So I'm pretty sure everyone in this room has been told by media lecturers, like media staff, you should listen to like AM on ABC in the morning and then you should, you know, read the newspapers and then you should watch this at night and whatever. My job is to make sure that when I start work, I'm completely read into the news. No one tweets between the hours of before 8 a.m. So what happens is between 8 a.m. and 10 o'clock is when you send your tweets, because before that, just fave them all and then send them between 8 and 10 because no one's online before 8. Everyone's getting into work. Everyone's getting onto the buses. Everyone's going to train. They're looking at their phones. And then there's a dead zone between like 10 and 1 o'clock where no everyone's like working. So you like don't publish anything. And then between like 1 and 4, you can publish and tweet. And then between like 4 and 7, don't publish anything because everyone's at the gym or like cooking or picking up the kids. And then like after 8 to 12 is like... So I always think to myself, I've got those windows in the day in which I should be on social media. I sound like I'm like Kevin Spacey from Seven or something. But like, it's sort of like the thing you need to do is you need to be a little bit weird and obsessed to be a really good news reporter, because you need to want to know the latest. Like, for all the bullshit that I will hang on right-wing conservative press, I read the Daily Telegraph, the Australian, and all that sort of stuff, because you need to be knowing what everyone who's making decisions are reading. David Crow from The Australian, like, is one of Malcolm Turnbull's favourite political reporters. So when David Crow writes something, you should consume it vociferously, because what you need to know is that what Malcolm Turnbull is reading and respecting. So I think that you need to do those things. And I also podcast a lot. There are probably about 6 politicians that are reliably viral on the internet. Pauline Hanson, Penny Wong, Paul Keating, who else? Tony Abbott. There's 2 others I'm forgetting because this is like a general thing that I say. But like, there's 2 others, right? So like, imagine this. Paul Keating says anything, write a story on it, because everyone on the internet cares about Paul Keating and they want to share a story about Paul Keating. Penny Wong, Julia Gillard is another one. Everyone loves Julia Gillard on the internet. Write a story about, like, Julia Gillard becomes the new head of Beyond Blue. Write a story about it, because everyone on the... This is the problem about the sharing world we live in now, is that BuzzFeed, quite often, me, myself included, you worry about whether a story is going to go well and it's going to traffic. And you think about how, like, will people share this? And if people will share it, it's a good indication of whether you think it's newsworthy. Because we live online now, and we live on Facebook, and we live on Twitter, and we live on Instagram, we live on Snapchat. If you think that something is shareable inherently, it kind of sometimes often means that it's a good piece of, it's a piece of news.
Is there a case now that something that someone tweets, if they'd said it themselves, you probably wouldn't write a story about it?
Malcolm Roberts.
Because they tweeted it, it becomes a story.
So Pauline Hanson and Malcolm Roberts, the One Nation thing is a good example of that, right? So it's like, I don't know if people have been watching this recently. So Malcolm Roberts and Pauline Hanson have been having this war against the ABC, and Malcolm Roberts compared the ABC to ISIS. And you just think to yourself, you tweet it and it gets 200 retweets, and you think to yourself, there's clearly an idea that you would what you'd share, but like, it's not news. The guy is deliberately doing it to bait progressive news organizations to cover him. And so often you just need to sit on your hands and just be like, nah. Like, what's going on at the moment in Australia? We will suffer the Brexit Trump thing if we don't make good editorial decisions.
Now, moving on to your book, I had a chat to three members of the political class, asked them what their thoughts on your book were, and all three people came back with a line that was pretty much the same, where they called your book a piece of political porn.
Yes.
Now, why did you feel that the 2016 election was an election worth writing a book about?
Because they asked me to write a book. That's right. No, genuinely, that is the reason why. But, like, I shouldn't say that. Louise Adler, who's the head of Melbourne University Press, asked me to live tweet a reading of one of her publishing house's books. And I said, Mum, I'm not going to do that. That's a weird thing to do. And she was like, well, when are you going to write a book for me? This is in December, 2 years ago. And I said, oh, I'll write a book about the election. And she's like, great, let's get a coffee. So I had a coffee with her and she said, what could you do about this year's election? And I said, well, I really, really, really love this guy named Michael Hastings, who used to work for BuzzFeed and Rolling Stone and has since passed away, unfortunately. And I was really inspired by his writing about politics. It's funny that you say the P word porn, because the way that Michael described politics was just this, like, it exposed just how dirty political messaging and politics and the process of writing stories was. And I think that that's what I wanted to do. Like, I wanted to write a story about what it's actually like. And it's not nice. Being a political journo is not fun all the time. It's disgusting. And you're talking to awful people all the time. And you're talking to, like, you're in situations where people are, journalists who you respect are covering for politicians. And you're like, what are you doing? Like, this is not your role and it's not your job. But I wanted to write a diary because we wanted to get it out really, really quickly after the election. This came out. I gave the draft 1 week after the result. And it was like 60,000 words 1 week after. I had really bad mental health, anxiety attacks to get it done. But I'm really glad it's done. And, like, I mean, I think Annabelle Crabb, who is like my idol, has been my idol for like a decade. She wrote the quote on the back. What does it say on the back? It's like,
Mark DeStefano is relentless, nosy, indiscreet, outrageous, and at any given moment guaranteed to be giving someone somewhere the shit.
Yeah.
A terrific journo, in other words.
Yeah, and I think that that's like kind of, you know, like Annabelle, to write that about me was just like, I felt, that's the kind of journo I want to be. Like, I don't want to be friends with Malcolm Turnbull. It's kind of, you kind of want to sometimes. You're like, I kind of like a few people who are politicians, but your job is adversarial. And that's the thing you need to remember. It's like, your job is to be there for the audience. Your job is not there to, like, become mates with the treasurer. Your job is to, like, give the treasurer a hard time about his bad decisions.
Does that mean that to be adversarial with everyone, everyone has to be attacking you from all sides, saying that you're biased to the other side?
There's this really interesting differentiation between the ideas of, should journalists be skeptical or cynical? And I think that the difference between skeptical and cynical is, like, maybe the most stark difference in politics or journalism. It's like, should you trust in politicians that they've got their hearts in the right place, so you're skeptical? Or should you think that politicians are constantly on the lookout to sell their message, so you should be cynical? Probably the best cynical journalist in Australia when it comes to someone who treats politicians like they're always trying to hoodwink people is Bernard Keane at Crikey. Never going to write anything nice about a politician, but he's cynical, and that's good. Someone who's skeptical and is amazing, David Spears at Sky News. When David Spears interviews someone on Sky News, I literally have to turn it up, like, because we have Sky muted in our office. I turn it up because what he does, he sits there and goes, but I don't understand. Like, what you're saying to me just does not make sense. And he'll do that to George Brandis, Christopher Pyne, Malcolm Turnbull. He did this interview with last year in the election where Malcolm Turnbull did not release the costings for the company tax cuts over 30 years. And David Spears just sat there and asked him the same question 18 times. But he did it in a way that wasn't infuriating, that made Malcolm Turnbull look like a moron. Because David Spears is sitting there going, no, Prime Minister, I'm just wondering how much it costs. And Malcolm would be like, blah, 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 blah. And then David's like, no, you didn't answer my question. I'm just wondering, this is like your like key policy, company tax cuts. How much does it cost? And he did it 18 times. And he made Malcolm Turnbull melt. And the next day they released their costings because of that. And he did the same thing with George Brandis with a metadata interview, like famously. The genius of that was David Spears being like, oh no, I don't understand what you're talking about. Like, you're not making any sense. But he was doing it in such a beautifully loving way that George Brandis didn't shut down or didn't attack David. He was just like, I'm melting. So I think that there's two ways to go. You can go cynical, you go skeptical, and you can sort of move between the two. And I think that both are healthy. Memes play a strange role in politics. The way I talk to other politicians about memes, because they will sometimes, like, a senator will come to like, Mark, you're from BuzzFeed. Tell me about these memes. And you're like, well, okay, like, where do we start? Like, the best way I can explain it is imagine this way. Tony Abbott eats an onion. It's absurd. It's so ridiculous. It played into the meme of him being a completely weird lizard person. Like, this really strange, out of touch. Like, the reason why that resonated so much, that image of him eating an onion, because it, like, reinforced the meme about who he was. Malcolm Turnbull, the meme about him at the last election wasn't about innovative and agile memes or whatever, blah, blah, blah. It was about he was Mr. Harbourside Mansion, that he was out of touch, that he owned this house in Port Piper, that he didn't care. So when the reason why a meme can take off is when something is fed into the current status of the way people think. So Bill Shorten eating the sausage sandwich the wrong way, that reinforced people's like perceptions that he's a strange man. So I think that the thing to remember about memes, it's like you can have literal memes, but then you can have political memes. So you can have like literal like memes that like surround people, and the things that become, I think there's a huge body of work about this, about Donald Trump. It's like the reason why the grab them by the pussy tape was so damaging is because it reinforced the thing that people thought most about him, which is he was a creep. Tax records, all that sort of stuff, people don't care about because they already knew that he was a tax, you know, someone who was like minimizing his tax. But the grab by the pussy tape was the one that really took off because it was like, I knew it. You are a sexual assaulter, allegedly. And I think that that's the same thing about politics. It's like the only thing, it only becomes damaging when it plays into people's perceptions about who they really are.
Now, could you just run us through your average day in yes. Parliament House?
Alice Workman and I work in a cupboard, and we get in, like, I wake up at 6. I usually try to go for a run or something. I listen to AM radio between 7 and 7.30 on Radio National, and then I listen to Fran between 7.30 and 8, and I usually get into work at about 7.30, and then we start listening to Ray Hadley in the office on 2GB, and then usually what we do is Alice and I have talked about what we're going to do. And then we have an editorial meeting at 9:15 with the Sydney office. And then like the rest of the day between 9:15 and 2 o'clock, when question time starts, is that we try to get about 3 or 4 stories out, because we know that it's so busy that there's always stuff happening. There's always like a press conference in a childcare center in like Goulburn. And so you drive out there where Malcolm Turnbull is. 2 to 3:30, you've got question time. We're usually trying to do an interview between 3:30 and 5. And then between like 5, as I was saying before, like 5 and 7, everyone's off the internet. So you can actually take some time to get some dinner and all that sort of stuff. And then afterwards, like it's Monday night, you have to watch Q&A and Four Corners. So you're usually getting to bed about 10:30, 11 o'clock, and then you start at 6. You have to wake up at 6 a.m. the next morning. But I think that there's no average day, but the average day usually consists of trying to figure out things that you know that are really going to take off because they reflect normal everyday life. As an example was Labor MP Terry Butler, who's excellent. She's a great person. I'm the skeptical person now, not the cynical one. Terry Butler said to Ian Goodenough, a coalition backbencher, when he was talking against gay marriage, she got up and like said this like 15-second thing. It was really quick and no one else was listening to it, but I was listening to it. I was in the house and I was listening to it. And it was like, Mr. Goodenough, I've known you for a long time. And let's just say that I understand why you've been single for so long. Let's just say that don't bring that line out on the first date. And isolated, like if we didn't cover it, no one would have covered it. But because it played into this aspect of this like woman telling this like conservative man, like, dude, this is why you're single, which is kind of what it'd be an interaction that would happen at a bar. I always think that that's kind of one of the reasons that journalists forget that like they want their politicians to act like normal people. And when those things happen, that's when we know that there's going to be a story there. So, yeah.
Mm. What are your thoughts on Adam Bandt's push to change the dress code for journalists in the gallery?
So they should. It's really strange that men in the press gallery have to wear blazers and women can't wear sleeveless tops. It's just like, it's 2017. This is a bit ridiculous. And also, women on the floor of parliament can't breastfeed, which is a bit dumb. Kelly O'Dwyer, who is the assistant treasurer, she's just about to have her second child. She is the first cabinet minister to ever take maternity leave. And that's just outrageous. We should just relax more. That would be great.
So there's a few changes that need to happen at yes. Parliament House. All right. So could you just very quickly run us through, how did you get from university to where you are now? Where did you get your start in student journalism?
I used to always be really freaking out about where you guys are seated right now. Like I'm a very anxious person. I have really bad anxiety. And I used to go home and I'd be like, fuck, I didn't get a cadetship again for the 7th time. And my boss, Ben Smith, talks about the one thing he looks for in journalists. This is a really good lesson. It's not video production. Sorry, Jack. But like, it's raw aggression. Like, it's actually just like not taking no for an answer. You get hung up on 3 times. You call a 4th time. You show up to events. You don't be scared to ask questions at press conferences. How did I do it? Look, the long form podcast on is one of the best podcasts around, and it's like got 300 episodes and I've listened to every single one, I think. The one thing I've learned is that you cannot take anyone's path to success. You got to do your own. But the one thing I would say is that might be hard, but like get out of Sydney and Melbourne. Like you've got to move. Move to Tamworth. I went to Darwin. I went to Darwin for a year. It was the best year of my life. I was a boy who was wearing skinny jeans and going out to like country, and Indigenous leaders would be like, why are you wearing skinny jeans? And I'd be like, that's all I have. And I was so out of place. And I did it for a year and I loved it so much. But I would not be where I am. I would not have my job at BuzzFeed if not for 2 things. One, going to Darwin and living in Darwin. And the second thing would be Twitter, because Twitter was the way I got onto my boss's radar. And Twitter is an amazing example of whether you are a good journalist or not. It's no surprise to me that Barry Cassidy and Laura Tingle and George Megalogenis and Laurie Oakes are all guns at Twitter. Like, do you know why? Because they're guns at being a journalist. Because they're firing off stuff that is like wry and witty and funny. Twitter is a really good distillation about whether you're going to be a good journal or not. Because if you can't tweet, it usually is an indication that you can't distill information from complex things to 140 characters. It's not to say that there aren't great journalists who aren't on Twitter. There are. But usually if you're a good journal, you're a good journal on Twitter. And don't start a blog. No one reads your blog. People do read your Twitter feed.
That's it from us on Fourth Estate. Thanks to our guest, Mark DiStefano. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Fourth Estate podcast. If you already subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show and lets us know what you like and what you don't like. My name's Jack Begbie, and you can catch us at the same time next week.